I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Sloan, director of the Institute for Oral History at Baylor University. We talk about what makes Waco a great news town for the last two centuries, and what we can learn from looking at its past to help inform its future. But before that conversation, it's the Small Business Spotlight, presented by American Bank.
Well, you know, when you get your shoes shined, it puts a little pep in your step. It makes you feel like a senator, or like you're walking around like you're Obama or something, like a Brad Pitt or somebody. When a man gets a shoe shine, he got a little swagger in the step, you know.
Silent Manor started shining shoes 35 years ago at Fort Hood as a member of the National Guard. He never considered it a career until he ended up on the ugly side of an auger while working at a poultry butchering plant.
My leg got mangled right up in there with the chicken feathers, guts. I'm really lucky, blessed to be alive. Because once you get caught, it just sucks you on down the line. I tell people all the time, when you get caught with something like that, you don't have time to say, in the name of the Father, name of the Son. No, just three words, God help me. And otherwise, I would have went to heaven that day spitting out feathers and puff, puff.
After the injury, his leg was amputated. Now relegated to a wheelchair, Silent's professional options were limited. But when his younger sister, Marsha, opened Sassy Southern-style food, he was motivated to find a new gig of his own.
And I don't know if you call it a sibling rivalry or what, but I tell people all the time that how I remember when we were kids, one summer we was at the swimming pool, and I was comfortable diving off the low diving board, but I was kind of scared of the high diving board until one day she was like, look at me. And I looked up there, and I can't be outdone by my baby sister. You know, now I got to get up there. So when she opened up her business, I was like, if she could open start a business, so can I. If it ain't nothing but shining shoes.
Silent's spectacular shoe shine and boot care has now expanded to four locations, at the Roosevelt Tower, the Courtyard Marriott, and Extraco Event Center. I first met Silent hustling from his stand in the downtown Hilton, which sits directly across from our Pokio shop in the hotel lobby.
You know, I'd rather be doing this and rather than being out there with a sign, we'll work for food. And, you know, this place I got down here at the Hilton, like I said, don't you know you could get your shoes shined and get some Pokio's ice cream at the same doggone time? You know, you can't beat that. Can't beat that with two sticks.
A shine takes about 10 minutes, sometimes more if the shoe needs extra TLC. He chooses a brush, opens a fresh can of shine, and gets to work.
I could dye in purple, red, green. I got all the colors, light brown, regular brown, dark brown, blue, midnight green. I like to take a, you know, do a thorough job. As a matter of fact, the worse they are, the more I love them. Give me the boots that you don't even want to donate to Goodwill.
He's buffed the Oxfords of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, gospel singer Kirk Franklin, and the iconic actor Bill Murray, whose son coaches for Xavier University.
So whenever they play Baylor in basketball, you know, he's here, walking around in a bathrobe. And yeah, he's a character, Bill Murray.
At the end of every shine, Silent dabs the shoes with frankincense and myrrh, blessing his customers with traveling mercies.
You know, because like I say, all ministry is not from the pulpit, so I just try to bless people and do what I do. And I haven't had to borrow any money, you know, in a while, you know, so it keeps me going.
In those 10 minutes, with your feet up on the stand, you never know what story's coming next. But Silent makes one thing for certain. When you leave, you're walking out with a shine on your shoes and a smile on your face. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, shining the small business spotlight on Silent Spectacular. The Small Business Spotlight is presented by American Bank, with three convenient locations in town, including an expanded branch downtown at Franklin and 4th. I'm now joined in studio for our monthly installment of the Chef's Corner. Chef Corey McIntyre from Milo is in the studio. And Chef, we often discuss food here on the program, but there's some really interesting wines being bottled right now.
Oh, yeah. There's an incredible amount of fun wine that are both coming into Texas, things that are being produced in Texas, and then what you're seeing, how people are collaborating. You know, Jester King and Southhold and Jester King and Cruz de Comal. And I think that you're seeing some people do some that are doing very similar things in different parts of the beverage industry, coming together and doing some really fun stuff.
So Jester King is that brewery in Austin area that's really famous for sours and fermentation.
Yeah.
They're partnering with winemakers. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So they're doing a thing, kind of like a co-bottling barrel age program with Southold Farms in particular, and then Cruz del Comal, doing some kind of spontaneous fermentations and then seeing what happens when they do aged beer in it and then aged wine in it and then aged beer in it again. And it's just a lot of fun to see people just testing the limits of what can and what people will drink.
There is so much innovation happening in the drink space, and one of the people leading the vanguard for that is Matthiessen Wines out of California.
Oh, man, I love these guys. My wife and I went out there a couple years ago, and got to visit with Steve and Jill Matthiessen, who are making some really, really fun wines out in Napa. They're doing kind of like an old-world style wine where they're just being true to the grape, being true to the land, and they're funky, cool people.
And that literally creates more delicious bottles when you're doing it sustainably in the right way.
Absolutely. You know, you go from 2014, totally different than 2015, totally different than 2016. And just to get to see how the land kind of vibes with the different years and what the winemaker is really enjoying of what's coming out of the land. But then once they bottle and ferment it, what happens after that? And it's just such a live process when you're doing it that way, that it's so cool to get to work alongside people that are doing things that are just – very spontaneous.
I've been hearing a lot about natural wines recently. What is natural wine?
So natural wine is kind of defined as being biodynamic and organic practices. So biodynamic is planting, picking, kind of according to a lunar cycle. There's also some mysticism into it too. I don't know a lot about that, but it's just an ethos of being true to the land, you know, where you're not going to plant an apple orchard where they're never going to grow. You're not going to plant strawberries when it's freezing all year long. And so it's planting grapes where they need to be planted and picking them at the right times.
There is a particular wine shop in town, The Wine Shop, with the purveyor David Mayfield, who really has a focus on these natural wines. And Milo is going to be partnering with David Mayfield Selections to bring some terrific bottles to the table and food on the table.
Absolutely. You know, the thing with David is he was there at the very beginning with us and really helped us get started and started to work alongside me in particular, of really interesting me in all these different wines and how they work well with the food, different acids, different grapes, different locations, all that. David was there at the very beginning of Milo. And so to kind of call back to those days and get him to come alongside us and come into the restaurant and educate people on really delicious wines that they can buy right down the street, and then it gives us a chance to kind of throw things against the wall and see how much fun we can have.
What is some of the seasonal produce that you guys will be using to pair with these terrific natural wines?
You know, cauliflower is one of my favorite things. You know, there's a couple different preparations we're doing right now. You and I both ate at State Bird Provisions in San Francisco. They do this buffalo cauliflower. We're actually doing Romanesco. And you make a buffalo vinaigrette. You lightly fry it, and it's really beautiful. Make a blue cheese aioli with that, too. Giardiniera, which is a pickle that you can make, you know, with carrots, cauliflower, maybe some peppers, maybe some hot oil, and then just a really nice brown butter roasted cauliflower with a bunch of thyme and herbs on there as well.
Chef Corey McIntyre checking in from the Chef's Corner here on Downtown Depot. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man.
I'm now joined in studio by Dr. Stephen Sloan. Dr. Sloan is an associate professor of history at Baylor and also the director of the Institute for Oral History at the university. Welcome to Downtown Depot.
Thanks, Austin. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your Waco history.
So as you acknowledge both my hats. So I teach in the history department, so I'm interested in U.S. history, but I'm especially interested in local history. And then at the Institute for Oral History, we do interview projects related to a lot of different topics. But one thing we've always interviewed on is McLennan and Waco history. We've got over 1,000 interviews in our collection related to local history on pretty much any topic you can think of. And so I became interested a few years ago when I came back to Waco, the fact that we didn't have a local history museum that interpreted Waco's history. We had a soft drink museum. We had a mammoth museum. we had all these neat institutions, but I thought Waco's a place that really needs a fuller understanding of its history. And because I am a educator, I can't build a bricks and mortar solution to that. But Waco History, which is wacohistory.org, became a tool to use to tell some of these great stories of our past and share some of the great digital images from the Texas Collection, who's a partner on the project, and get some of these voices out of our archives that we have in our oral history recordings and share those as well.
You were a student at Baylor as an undergraduate and also did grad work here. Did you live in Waco before going to school, or what brought you to Baylor initially?
So I came to Baylor in 86, and that was back in a time that's just what all good Baptists did. When you graduated from high school, you went to Baylor. And so I was in Waco from 86 to 90, met my wife here. But much like many Baylor students, I didn't have much of a notion of Waco as a community. And so it's really been, since I've been back since 2007, an opportunity to kind of explore this place, which historically, it's a fascinating place.
I had J.B. Smith from the Waco Trib on Downtown Depot. Now, it was probably last year. But he said that in the news world, Waco, for its size, really punches above its weight. It's really considered a terrific news town, even though it is small in stature. But it seems like there have been terrific stories coming out of this area of Central Texas for long before the Waco Trib was even here recording them.
There has been, and I appreciate JB because he writes with a historical mindset.
He does.
He's a historian who's a journalist, or a journalist who's a historian. But I think that's true. I think there's some great Waco stories and great local things that people just don't know about. And so this tool and then the podcast that Randy came to me and we developed last fall, the Waco History Podcast, offer kind of an opportunity to explore some of that history together. And so it's been neat for people who have lived here their whole lives to say, oh, I never knew that, or I didn't realize that, and become and have a greater appreciation for our local history. Because I also think Waco, people have very narrow associations with Waco nationally. And so it's great to also see usership of both the podcast and the app internationally. And so I'm sure they come to Waco with a certain idea of what Waco is and the history of Waco, but they leave with a much fuller understanding, a much richer understanding of who we are as a community.
On this excellent podcast that you host with Randy Lane, who is the grandson or great-grandson
of Randy, of Roy E. Lane, the local architect.
And Randy and you have been diving into Waco's history. Randy is a guy who served in the Navy and had ties to the area, but doesn't know a lot about Waco. And so you're there to sort of be the educational insight and walk Randy through some really cool topics and pieces of Waco history. Recently, you guys discussed Waco 20 million years ago, I think it was. And we're talking about, not 20 million, but we're talking about mammoths that were in this area, saber-toothed cats that they found there at the Waco Mammoth Site. There are stories for anyone when you look at Waco, depending on what your interest level might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Waco's always been a crossroads. It's always been geographically this crossroads, and I would say culturally, economically, it's always been very central in that sort of crossing point. And so because of that, there's a lot of stories that are of national importance that somehow cross the story of Waco as well. And so, yeah, it's fun to explore these together. Randy brings the whole skill set. He's the podcaster. I'm just a guy who likes history.
Tell me about Waco in the 1800s. So the Waco Indians, if I remember correctly, were an offshoot of the Wichita tribe and had migrated down south. And they were living in this area in the 1700s and 1800s?
We don't know exactly when they begin to move into the area, but they actually probably move in to more of the late 1700s, early 1800s. And so they were fairly recent arrivals into the area. And the encampment, as far as the main encampment of the Waco Indians, was over kind of on Waco Drive there, Waco Drive near kind of that 6th Street area. There's beautiful elms over there in that area now. And so, yeah, they're an interesting tribe. Didn't use the river that much, but we're here because of the great springs that existed in this area. And so I think every group that's come through has seen kind of the benefits of kind of settling in this area.
You obviously have an intimate look at Waco's history and know it better possibly than anyone else on planet Earth right now. When you look at the last, say, 200, 250 years of Waco history, do you have a favorite moment or a favorite story?
That's an impossible question to answer, Austin, but you're going to try.
Do you have a favorite child?
Like that. You know, it changes all the time because I continue to learn more. One of the things I love about my job is I'm never going to know all of it. And so just the opportunity to continually be in the role of student. So James Andrew Harris, which I've been researching lately, who's an African-American from here in town, went to A.J. Moore Academy. He's the first African-American to participate in the discovery of new elements that are on the periodic table. And so I love the fact that that's here, that has a connection to here. I worry sometimes we think about history as happening in other places. And we know about George Washington Carver, but let's know about James Andrew Harris as well, because it's got a local tie. It's something extremely interested in that happened right here in town. And so those sort of local connections and the ways in which this place is connected to bigger and larger things and bigger and larger phenomena, I find endlessly interesting.
You had mentioned earlier that there wasn't a history museum in Waco. You know, we have the Dr. Pepper Museum and, of course, the Shrine to Chip and Joanna there.
Great institutions.
I see that there's that building, the Taylor Museum, over off Waco Street, or Waco Drive, rather. What is that, and is there any hopes for it being reopened?
Actually, Randy and I sat down with Helen Marie Taylor in December, did an interview with her for a future possible podcast, and it closed in the late 1990s over some disagreements of funding, and there's really no near prospect of it being reopened. Just in visiting with her about it, there's not a plan for it to be reopened anytime soon. And so it's a shame. I feel like even though we've done this digital history project, I would love for it at some point to go to inform some physical exhibits and some space that we can all go at, some community space where we can all go to and enjoy kind of our shared history.
What kind of artifacts are in the Taylor Museum right now?
Well, it is a little bit of a mix. It's got Bobby Barnes' Cotton Palace Dress Collection, so these Cotton Palace dresses from back in the day, the Cotton Palace, which was a huge event here in town. It's got the bell from the Dory Miller, which was just shipped, named in memory of Dory Miller. It's got some artifacts from the Branch Davidian trials, a mock-up of the compound that's there. It's got a vest of George Washington in it, and so it's Zachary Taylor's bed. So it's a little bit of a mix of different kind of historical elements related to local history, but also some that relate to national history.
So it's not just in the purview of Waco. It's really American history.
It's not. It's much broader than that. And so there's definitely some things in Waco that it could develop more, but I think kids that went there got to see a broad kind of picture of American history as well.
You're hearing from Dr. Stephen Sloan here on Downtown Depot. Even outside of the Taylor Museum, the Waco History app, which is free and able for you to download, is an incredible resource. And I love walking in downtown, pulling up the app, seeing my location on the map, and then I can see photos of the building that used to be there or audio recordings of the janitor who used to sweep the floors. How did this idea of recording or, you know, compiling all of this history into an app come about?
Well, I justified it by the fact that I have this huge oral history collection. And what's happened in recent years, Texas Collection, my partner on the project, has this huge photographic collection. So while they've been digitizing their photographs, I've been digitizing my analog audio. And so these things in many ways became available in a digital form for the first time. And so Waco History offered a way for all that to kind of come together and present it to new audiences. And so we started it about 4 years ago. Now we've got about 170 entries on it. I was confessing that I now see pins on the map as I drive through town. I think of things as we got a pin there, we got a pin there, and, oh, we need a pin there. And so it's in telling these stories, and they're place-based stories, they're much more than Wikipedia entries. And so I would encourage folks to use it. That's why we built it.
You were the past president of the National Oral History Association. Why are oral histories as a medium so important?
I think oral history is important on a lot of different levels. One, there's a lot of people that are left out of the historical record. The historical record is not neutral. There's some people that are over-documented, and there's others that are under-documented. And history is also so much the way in which we perceive it. Someone asked me to do a Waco history lecture. One question I'll ask them is, what perspective do you want it from? Because it depends on what perspective you experience Waco history. It could be a radically different history. And so oral history allows us a way to capture those perspectives, to capture people's first-person experiences the way they want to share them and the way they want to present them. And the only way I can understand your view, Austin, and the way in which you perceive life is by you trying to explain it to me. And oral history offers that opportunity, and we can learn from it.
In the news recently, fresh off of its award-winning Best Picture, is The Green Book. And it's a movie that's in theaters right now, but this was a real living document, an important part of lives of African Americans in the mid-20th century. And there were some Green Book locations in Waco.
Yes. Yeah, one of the things on the app is the College View Hotel, which was up near Paul Quinn College, what was Paul Quinn College then. In fact, it's just north of Garrison Street there if you're driving north on your right. One thing I've got laying in my office is a little pink tile that I took from kind of the remnants of the College View Hotel that are there. But yeah, there were these locations and that connects directly, Austin, to perspective. Your view of traveling through Waco is very different from much of Waco's history, depending on what color your skin is. And so that makes that history very different and makes that perspective very different. So oral history offers a way to kind of capture that. How else could I understand these viewpoints or how different individuals have experienced history unless they try to explain it to me?
It seems like East Waco is in the news all the time now with the resurgence of the Elm Avenue corridor. And on a podcast that you and I recorded a few weeks ago together, along with Garrett Simmons of the Wacoans and your podcast partner, Randy Lane, we talked about East Waco and its past and present and future. Can you give our listeners a quick overview of what East Waco was and why, when you look at it now, seems like a decrepit corridor, but this was really a hub for not just African Americans, but even before that, a hub for Waco?
Yeah, and as we think about responsible development, I think responsible development is historically minded. And so I think we keep our past in mind. The past is not a mistake, it's our identity. And we think about that as we move toward trying to do things in the future. One of my favorite things in town right now is the Waco High Lofts. I love that adaptive reuse where it's acknowledging our history. And we still have a historical artifact there where some may have said, let's scrape it off the map and build something new. There's ways to develop with an appreciation of history that I think is extremely powerful. But you were asking about East Waco. So East Waco, traditionally, the color line in East Waco was up on Garrison Street. There was the hill, and there were the flats, that area down lower of Garrison Street as you move down toward the river. So if we think that area corresponding Elm Avenue, those housing developments there. And traditionally, the color line was up on the hill, and so those brick houses that are down Dallas Street, Rush Street, and others were primarily white housing, a white middle-class housing. And if we think about Waco's landscape, traditionally Bridge Street, which would have been on the other side of the suspension bridge, was an African-American business district, a very active African-American business district. And so a lot changes in kind of reordering the color line in Waco, everything from the tornado contributing to it to urban renewal, which contributes to it greatly, to white flight that contributes to it. As whites are moving out of the downtown area to suburban areas, African Americans move into that flat area to get some of those nicer homes, some of those nicer brick homes, moving out of shotgun houses and other other wooden homes that would have been up on the hill.
What can we take from studying Waco's past that helps inform its future?
I think what we can learn is more voices need to be listened to. I think we need to listen to the full community. Waco, much like other southern/western towns, hasn't done a great job of listening to the full community at times in deciding how development goes. And so I think we can learn that there are these different rich areas of town, and there's different perspectives there that need to be heard as we move forward with development.
Are there parts of Waco history in particular that you're thinking of that it would have been really nice had there been a more diverse set of perspectives discussed?
Well, I think particularly with urban renewal, which is not talked about a lot, it really clears out a lot of African-American neighborhoods, Mexican-American neighborhoods. These are primarily renters in substandard housing, but it's devastating to these communities, and it dissipates these communities. And so I think of moments like that that could have offered an opportunity to dream about different possibilities for development ended up just with the wrecking ball.
And that was a program that was pretty crippling to a lot of communities across the country.
It was. It comes out of this panic over urban deterioration. But it wasn't looking for creative solutions. It was looking for simple solutions.
As you look into 2019 and the work you're wanting to continue at Baylor, what's something on your plate right now that's really intriguing to you?
With the app, we're looking to continue development, develop it. I'm looking to do particularly more on, we've been doing a lot of African-American history and Latino-Latina history here locally. So developing a lot of that and also looking at local businesses. I think as Waco becomes a place that sometimes we measure its progress by do we have a this and do we have a this like everyone else has. I think we need to celebrate and lift up some of these local businesses that have been here for a long time and with Waco's ups and downs have always been part of the community.
Like which businesses are you talking about?
There's a lot of local restaurants that we highlight on the app. There's a lot of local businesses. I don't know that I want to name any, but there's a lot of local businesses that I think could deserve more attention.
If I'm someone who is new to Waco, or I'm not even particularly interested in history, why is listening to the Waco History Podcast or downloading the app and checking into my surroundings, why is that important for me, and how can that help build my sense of place and community?
Yeah, I don't think you know where you are until you know where you've been. Your place matters. Place is extremely important. And so I think having an appreciation of the history of the place that you're in, I think of the moment that we're in, as a nation, context is extremely important, but it's often something that we ignore and we don't think about. And so I think looking at our history gives you a context. I think it helps deepen your roots in your community. It gives you more of an appreciation for where you live and where you're engaged. I think it makes you a better citizen. I think it makes you a better neighbor. And so I think there's all sorts of reasons to do it. I know we're worried about the future and preoccupied with the present, but I think taking some time to focus on the past is extremely important.
Dr. Stephen Sloan, Director of the Institute for Oral History at Baylor University, thank you so much for coming on Downtown Depot.
Thanks for having me, Austin.
Thanks again to Dr. Stephen Sloan, Silent Manor, American Bank, Corey McIntyre, and you for tuning in this week. And if you're looking for more Waco content in between episodes of Downtown Depot on KWBU, be sure you're following Waco Business News on social media, and maybe check out the Waco History Podcast or the Wacoans on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you might get your audio content. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.